Hello and welcome to the Semantic Cybersecurity Brief, our weekly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien and joining me today are Semantic Threat Researchers Orla Cox and Bridget O'Gorman. In this week's podcast, we'll be talking about the ongoing controversy surrounding an allegation that chipboards manufactured by Supermicro have been compromised with unknown chips. We'll also be discussing the indictment of a Russian woman for her alleged role in a conspiracy to interfere in the US political system, and also how Twitter have released a massive archive of propaganda tweets. And we'll be taking a look at a group of ransomware operators who took pity on one of their victims. But first, we'll turn to the world of politics. A few weeks ago, we spoke about how the British Conservative Party suffered a bit of embarrassment when the official app for their annual party conference turned out to be insecure, prompting pranksters to alter party member profiles and, in some cases, send text messages to their cell phones. Now it's the turn of Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, who was left red-faced this week when he failed to renew the domain name for his personal website, scottmorrison.com.au. It wasn't long before an eagle-eyed Melbourne man named Jack Gennison spotted the domain name was available and, well, you can probably guess what happened next. Describing it as the most fun he's had with $50 in a long time, Gennison registered the domain name and promptly got to work. Given the power that he had at his fingertips, he was relatively restrained, and the new website featured a giant picture of a grinning Morrison playing what's been described in the press as a lewd rock song called Scotty Doesn't Know by the US band Lustre. By the time he woke up the next morning, the new website had gone viral and Gennison's phone was buzzing with texts, calls and emails, and he had more than 20 requests for media interviews. However, Scott Morrison's office was not among the callers. Slightly spooked by all the attention this was getting, he tried to contact the Prime Minister, offered the domain name back in good faith. He managed to speak to two different people, was told that someone from IT would get back to him. And it wasn't until the next day that someone from the domain auction service contacted Gennison, saying it was down to a third-party mistake as to why the domain had become available for auction and that the domain was to be returned to its previous owner, which is what he'd already offered to do. So all's well that ends well, and Scotty got his website back. Moving on to more weighty matters, we're going to turn our attention now to the Supermicro story, where there have both been accusations and denials that the company's chips have been compromised. Bridget, I gather there's been a lot of twists and turns to this story, so maybe you could bring us all up to speed.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, this story, like, it's been just rumbling around for the last few weeks. All over the cybersecurity and technology world, all over Twitter and that kind of thing. And it really doesn't seem to be going anywhere anytime soon. So this story, it originates from an article that was published in Bloomberg Businessweek at the start of October. And it made some like really serious claims about what they described at the time as Chinese spies infiltrating almost 30 US companies, including allegedly Apple and Amazon, by compromising the technology supply chain. So they're very serious claims, but these claims have been emphatically denied by Apple, by Amazon, as well as by Supermicro, which is the Chinese company at the center of all this, that Bloomberg has claimed had had its technology compromised.
Okay, right. So for those unfamiliar with the story so far, fill us in on what the original claims in the Bloomberg article were.
Yeah, sure. So to give a bit of context, Supermicro is a supplier of server motherboards, and according to the Bloomberg article, in spring of 2015, some of these motherboards were examined by an unnamed security company, and they discovered on the motherboard was, and I'm going to quote from the article now, a tiny microchip, not much bigger than a grain of rice, that wasn't part of the board's original design. And the boards were reportedly being examined in this instance as part of due diligence being undertaken by Amazon, as it was considering purchasing a company called Elemental Technologies, which use these Supermicro motherboards. The article claims that Amazon then reported this discovery to US authorities, and that this sent a quote, another quote, a shudder through the intelligence community, as Elemental Technologies software was widely used and was actually used in Department of Defense data centers and also apparently on board Navy warships. Now, the article claims that during a top secret probe, investigators determined that these chips allowed the attackers to create what's described as a stealth doorway into any network that included these boards. And it further claims that investigators found that the chips had been inserted at factories run by Supermicro manufacturing subcontractors in China, and what would constitute a supply chain attack. And the report then claims that investigators found that this attack had affected almost 30 US companies, including a major bank, which is unnamed, government contractors, as well as Apple, which the article claims found these malicious chips on Supermicro motherboards and subsequently stopped working with the company.
Wow, so that's a pretty massive story, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, if this is accurate, it's obviously a huge story, like one of the biggest kind of cybersecurity stories out there. But the reason that it's still, you know, rumbling on and there's still so much discussion about it is because of the emphatic denials from all the companies named in the story. Like Amazon, Apple and Supermicro have all rebutted the claims made in the article. And I mean, very emphatically in the article itself, they're quoted, Amazon is quoted as saying that it's untrue that they knew about a supply chain compromise, an issue with malicious chips or hardware modifications when they acquired Elemental. Apple said it never found malicious chips, hardware manipulations or vulnerabilities purposely planted in any of its servers. And Supermicro said it was unaware of any investigation. And since the publication of the article, the company's denials have only become more emphatic. And in the last few days, Tim Cook, the head of Apple, obviously, has called for Bloomberg Businessweek to retract the article. And in this call, he's been supported now by executives from Amazon, as well as the head of Supermicro itself as well. Like in an interview he did with BuzzFeed News, Cook really didn't mess around. And he said in relation to the claims in the Bloomberg article that this did not happen, that there's no truth to this. So, I mean, there's really no room for manoeuvre there at all. And these denials have also been backed up by government agencies with both the Department of Homeland Security in the US and the National Cybersecurity Center in the UK saying they've no reason to doubt the veracity of Amazon and Apple's denials. And Supermicro is also maintaining its denial of the story. And it says now it's planning to review its motherboards to see if it can discover any proof of these malicious chips that Bloomberg has alleged were on their servers.
So it's pretty rare to see such blanket and emphatic denials from all parties mentioned in the story. And in the light of that, is Bloomberg going to stick to its story?
It seems so, yeah. So far anyway, the article is still on its website. And Bloomberg published a sort of a follow-up of sorts in the aftermath of the original publication of the first story, which alleged that manipulated hardware had been discovered and removed from the systems of a US telecom. However, for that story, they primarily relied on one name source for most of the key claims. They said they had further supporting evidence and documents to back up that story, but they did not publish them either. And that story was written by the same two journalists who were linked to the original piece. And I mean, this is it. Like, one of the biggest problems for Bloomberg with the original disputed story is that all of the sources they've quoted, 17 of them, are anonymous. And one of the few people who was named in the story, a hardware expert who didn't have first-hand knowledge of the alleged hack but was used to comment on technical details in the story, he's kind of distanced himself since in a podcast. He distanced himself from the claims in the article and he said he was never contacted by a Bloomberg fact-checker either. And many people in the InfoSec community as well have cast some doubts on the plausibility of the hack, which when you combine that with the emphatic denials from the companies involved, doesn't make things look great for the story, really. Now, the calls for the story to be retracted have only come out in the last, over the weekend, I think. So we'll have to see what happens there, but I doubt it's the last we've heard of this story.
Yeah, no, definitely not. I mean, with two sides so emphatically sticking to their guns, I think this one is going to run for a while more.
Yeah, definitely.
So on the subject of ongoing sagas, we've had a few developments over the past week in relation to the 2016 US presidential elections and attempts to influence the outcome. The first bit of news came on Friday when a Russian woman was indicted in the US on charges that she played a role in the conspiracy to interfere in the US political system. Orla has been following this case. Can you tell me what's been happening here?
Yeah, there definitely seems to be like an uptick in activity around influence campaigns, or more specifically, activity against them. So as you mentioned there last Friday, a Russian woman whose name is Elena Kuzhainova was charged for allegedly attempting to interfere in the US political system and actually more specifically to influence the upcoming 2018 midterm elections in the US. So the woman in question here, she was part of a group which was named as Project Lacta. And her role in this group was actually managing the finances for the group. And according to the US Justice Department, that this group were, and I quote, attempting to sow discord in the US political system. So following the indictment, the US released the US Justice Department released some details around this group, and it kind of gives like an interesting insight into how these misinformation campaigns are actually carried out. And in the press release themselves, they actually refer to it as information warfare, so you know, quite strong language used against it. So this group, they would set up email and social media accounts, and they were set up to make it look like they were US citizens. And they actually went to, you know, a lot of, they went to great lengths really to disguise their origin. So they would use things like VPNs and proxy servers, so that you couldn't really see where they were originating from. And then they would use these accounts to then post on various quite divisive topics, so topics like immigration, gun control, and then some specific items like the NFL national anthem debate. And so it's interesting to see, like, this is an interesting aspect actually of all of these misinformation campaigns, is that they typically don't post on one ideology. So they're not, their motive isn't really to promote one ideology. And oftentimes you will see that they will post opposing views. So the motive here is definitely more about sowing like general discord and to increase conflict between various groups. And so it's interesting to see that kind of reinforced yet again in this particular influence campaign. So interesting to see some information come out about that.
Yeah, and particularly interesting to see them kind of playing both sides in this way. So just how big were the campaigns that this group were conducting?
Yeah, so it seems to be pretty significant and seems to be a well-organized group as well. And the press release from the Justice Department talked mainly about US operations. That's obviously what they were interested in. But there were some indications in there that the group were involved in activity outside of the US as well. And also there was indication of their budget. So according to the Justice Department, the group had an operating budget of $35 million for operations over the course of 2 years, so from 2016 to 2018. And also the scale of the campaign seemed pretty big. Some of the social media accounts they set up were able to amass like tens of thousands of followers and posted then also tens of thousands of messages, so quite significant campaigns. And an interesting aspect that I thought kind of gave an indication of really the sophistication of this group is that they had a playbook which apparently described the best way to formulate the messages, the best outlets to use, the best timing, you know, some very organized and very well conducted campaigns. So so kind of interesting insights there, and I suspect we'll be seeing more of this.
Yeah, I mean, these things are kind of typically referred to as troll farms, but this is a really slick, well-financed operation. It isn't, you know.
Yeah, it was definitely more than just bots here. Yeah, it was definitely much more organised.
Okay, and that kind of ties into the next thing that we wanted to discuss, because late last week, Twitter released a massive archive of all known tweets associated with two major influence campaigns it had found.
Yeah, so as you said last week, then Twitter made this announcement that it was going to release accounts and various content associated with influence campaigns. So the data set has the accounts and content for two particular groups or campaigns. So one was the Internet Research Agency, which has been linked to Russia, and some other accounts that were part of a separate group, which some believe may be located in Iran. And the content then dates back to 2016. And so it's quite a bit of content in there. So we're talking about over 4,000 accounts, 10 million tweets. Then it also has a couple of million other pieces of content, so things like images, videos, etc. And they've basically opened that up to anyone. Now, the data set that's been released for the general public, it has some details hashed of the accounts. So I think they were really just trying to protect maybe legitimate accounts that were compromised. So anyone can access that hashed data. But Twitter have also said that researchers can get access to then an unhashed data set. So you can apply if you're a researcher with some details maybe on what you're going to use this data for and get access to an unhashed data set. So interesting development there.
Yeah. And how significant of a move do you think this is on the part of Twitter?
It remains to be seen what comes out of it. I think it's an interesting move. The current approach to dealing with this sort of activity, it's a bit whack-a-mole, particularly in the case of, say, bots, and sometimes, you know, it's a bit reactive. You know, there have been a lot of moves to take down accounts associated with these campaigns, and also I know that Twitter has been notifying accounts as well when they've been seen to interact with what they believe are, you know, fake news accounts. But it's an interesting kind of approach, because it's like they're trying to maybe outsource or glean information from the broader research community and security community. And so, you know, by giving access maybe to broader researchers, maybe collectively we can come up with some sort of solution. So I think it's an interesting, maybe different approach to dealing with the problem. And it remains to be seen what, you know, if anything actually comes out of it.
Yeah, it is fascinating. I mean, when it came out on Friday, myself and our colleague Gillian Cleary were going through it, and just the sheer volume of information that came out. I mean, the archives are so big I couldn't even open them on my computer. But we were going through it and trying to figure out like what the top hashtags they used were. And it was quite interesting, because again, like the other operation you mentioned, it seemed like they were playing both sides. So Make America Great Again was one top hashtag, but also Black Lives Matter, which probably would be associated more with the, you know, the democratic side of things, was also one of the top hashtags, you know. So they seem to be trying to, you know, stir up discord rather than promote one side.
So it seems to be a trend through all of the activity we've seen on this.
This just seems to be one step they're taking to try, I suppose, and combat this kind of thing, because we're releasing some research now soon, hopefully, about kind of bot activity on Twitter and kind of the steps they're taking or trying to take to combat that. And this is one of them, actually soliciting kind of help nearly from developers outside of their own community to kind of try and improve the conversational health of Twitter and make it, I suppose, a bit less, I suppose, warped by these bots and things. And also, like, kind of underlines as well that how common, like how many accounts on Twitter are actually kind of bots is quite stark. And we outlined as well how to spot some of these bots and kind of the typical kind of behaviors of them. But I think certainly being divisive is one of the definite behaviors of a lot of these bot accounts that are out there to spread disinformation.
Okay, cool. And we're planning on publishing that in the next few days, aren't we?
Yes, hopefully, all going well.
Good. Now, finally, we wanted to talk briefly about ransomware, because ransomware attackers, I suppose, in our experience, are very rarely seem to have anything like sympathy for their victims. But there was a case this week where one group, at least, seemed to display some signs of having a conscience.
Yes, indeed. Yes, let's finish on a bit of a lighter note. So the developers behind the GansCrab ransomware recently showed that they are not totally heartless, after they responded to a plea from a Syrian father on Twitter. So the gentleman in question posted a message on Twitter saying that his two sons had been killed in a war that has been ongoing in Syria, obviously, for a number of years. And he said that all he had left of them were photos and videos, but that these had been encrypted by the GansCrab ransomware. And they were now looking for a $600 ransom, and he said he had no way to pay that. And it appears that this tweet was spotted by the developers behind GansCrab, and they subsequently posted to an underground forum that they had released decryption keys for all Syrian victims of the ransomware. And they added that it had been a mistake not to add Syria to the list of countries that GansCrab would not encrypt. So, however, for any victims of GansCrab in other countries who might be getting their hopes up and hoping that, you know, the developers are just after developing a benevolent streak. This seems to be a bit of a one-off, and they have said that they will never release the decryption keys for victims in other countries, and in fact they will delete them if they ever shut down GansCrab. So, you know, one good act, but they're not totally turning over a new leaf, shall we say.
It's only going so far.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Okay, I think that's all we have time for this week. But if you've been enjoying the podcast, don't forget to subscribe to avoid missing out on any upcoming episodes. You can also follow us on Twitter at ThreatIntel or Medium at medium.com/threat-intel. If you'd like to read our latest research, check out our blog, which can be found on semantic.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We'll be back again next week, when we'll be once again looking at what's going on in the world of cybersecurity. Until then, thank you and goodbye.